Save big on your next project at Menards. Check out our huge selection of Richmond water heaters. Whether it's electric or gas, tank or tankless, Menards has what you need in stock. Ensure that you have hot water for when you need it most with a new Richmond water heater from Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. There has been a certain genre of comment circulating lately that has tickled me. It's some variation of, "Sociologist, you owe Zara Larsson an apology because she's blowing up and you gave Midnight Sun a mean review." I've seen it as the top comment on many clips of Stateside or in interviews where Zara's talking about escaping the Kia asylum. "Sociologist, you were wrong. Sociologist, eat your words, retract what you said, look at the charts, get on your knees and repent for not saying Midnight Sun is a cultural reset." Before we go any further, let me explain this situation to my gorgeous, intelligent YouTube divas who do not live inside the Clock app's increasingly demented discourse ecosystem, because that's where all of this really popped off. A few months ago, I posted a review of Zara Larsson's album Midnight Sun. The review did very well, which in TikTok terms means it went terribly for my peace of mind. It went viral, reached a much larger audience than my reviews usually do, and quickly escaped the bounds of people who actually follow me or understand how I talk about pop music. Zara herself commented on the video, and her producer chimed in as well, and that brought even more attention to it. And then almost overnight, a whole new mini content genre emerged, people making reviews of my review, reactions to my review, rebuttals to points I supposedly made, and in quite a few cases, passionate speeches responding not to what I actually said, but to some mutated secondhand paraphrase of it. Now, to be fair, the review of Sociologist's review Industrial Complex did not begin with Zara Larsson, but this particular video amplified that trend on a scale that genuinely surprised me. I have had plenty of tomatoing before, and I do not expect everyone to share my taste. That is literally the point of criticism. But I can't remember the last time I watched so many people confidently misstate my argument, strip it of context, and then get incredibly angry at this new version of it that they invented. This is what really took me aback. Not the disagreement, I'm well used to that, and the fandom witch hunts, but disagreement with a made-up version of my review that doesn't exist. Being a music reviewer these days is kind of like being a social scientist. You get to see a lot of troubling trends in the collective consciousness unleashed in your comment section. Here's what I'm not going to do in today's video for anyone hoping for it. I will not grovel at Zara Larsson's feet with a bouquet and a handwritten apology because she got her first Hot 100 Top 10 feature. But I do want to give her some flowers and explore her rise to fame. I'm interested in discussing Zara Larsson as a phenomenon of this very moment because I study pop stars, and she's clearly ascending from a level 2 pop star on my list into something higher up that infamous ladder. And there's a wave of goodwill and a renewed attention towards her, a commercial momentum I'd say she's actually never had. That is worth talking about on its own. However, I feel like I'm not able to discuss her properly without clarifying some enduring misconceptions about my initial album review. I think today it would be an interesting exercise to sit with you and revisit that initial review of her album to show you why I still stand by it. Despite Zara's surge of interest, I don't take anything back. There's also a couple of broader questions that I would like to probe here with you today that I have discussed on this channel before and that I've been thinking about. I don't have a concrete answer on, so feel free to chime in while I think out loud with you in the comments about whether artists and their collaborators should be involving themselves in critics' business in this way, especially in an online culture that is currently so primed for pile-ons and bad faith readings, and also for public humiliation as some sort of collective social fandom ritual. The discourse around my Midnight Sun review is annoying because it's so banal. It collapses a bunch of interesting thought starters into one giant, stupid binary. Either Zara is having any kind of success and therefore I must have been wrong about everything, or I stand by my review and therefore I must secretly hate her and want her to fail. In 2026, criticism is either praise or cruelty. Ambiguity and tolerance is abound. There's no element of taste allowed. The audience implores you to be objective, despite that literally being the opposite of what a review is. Let me state my position that I made in the review, clearly again off the top for the impatient. I like Zara Larsson. I think she is talented. She is very charismatic and has always had obvious pop star raw materials. I am very happy to see her getting attention and her flowers. But that's not a new position of mine. I said all of that in my review, and I stand by everything else that I said in it as well. And the fact that those two statements seem impossible for some people to hold in their minds at the same time is, in many ways, the entire reason this video now exists. So I also want to explore if Zara is actually going to break out of the Kia asylum or not in today's video. And do I owe Zara Larsson an apology? No. I reviewed her album honestly and thoughtfully. I have nothing to be sorry for. but some people do. One of the most annoying things about this whole saga is that much of the backlash isn't actually a response to my review. It is a response to a more convenient, flattened version of my review that people invented because it was easier to dramatize, moralize, and dunk on. The best example of that is how people completely scrambled two different points I made about Zara Larsson, one about her songwriting and one about her production lineage. These are not the same point. They were made at different points in the review, and they're not even about the same thing. And yet people have been reacting as though I said one big xenophobic fever dream sentence about Sweden and expected Zara to come out in pigtails and clogs yodeling over a maple. Let's revisit the review and separate these points clearly, and I'll show you how they were misinterpreted. First was a critique of a song called Eurosummer. This was a point about lyricism and perspective.
Let's look at Eurosummer as an example. This is Zara trying to make a moment instead of just having one. The concept is straight from American TikTok fantasies. She's jetting around Europe, collecting men, taking hot Instagram pictures, except Zara is European. She's Swedish. For her, Eurosummer is literally just summer. But instead of writing from that perspective, she coughs up these generic lyrics about an experience that she doesn't have to appeal to an American audience and maybe get a viral TikTok sound.
What I mean here is actually quite simple. I'm not making a grand statement about Swedish culture, and I'm not saying that Zara Larsson has a duty to represent Sweden in her music or demanding a cultural performance from her. I don't want Midsommar the album. I'm making a point about her approach to songwriting. To me, her lyricism feels reductive and inauthentic in most places, but especially on Midnight Sun. It's like she's speaking towards a fantasy or writing with an imagined audience to impress in mind, rather than speaking from an exciting, interesting point of view, which I think she has, by the way. She's whip smart and very iconic in interview soundbites. There's no lack of personality in Zara Larsson, but there is a lack of personality in her music. My issue with Eurosummer is not that it is insufficiently Swedish. The whole point that I was making is that the concept feels secondhand to me. It feels like Zara Larsson narrating a TikTok fantasy of Europe rather than drawing from the reality of her own relationship to that experience. This is a matter of taste. I'm commenting on the lyrics and her perspective. The reason I brought up the fact that she is Swedish here is to point out the tension between the phrase Eurosummer as a fantasy sold online and Zara's actual proximity to Europe as a lived reality, which is emblematic of a broader songwriting problem I have with her. To me, it often feels like she is writing at the level of image and marketability rather than interiority. That is the point I was making. I'm not doing cultural essentialism or making a political argument. I'm not suggesting that she needs to foreground her heritage in a way that I find to be personally legible. She literally speaks in Swedish on this record. What I'm saying is, I think this song specifically is written from an externalized, generic, audience-facing fantasy rather than from a specific authored perspective. And yet somehow that became this.
This obsession with foreigners displaying their culture needs to stop. I don't know what you, do you want her to do the Trixie Mattel Swedish accent? What are you talking about?
That is just not what I said. This whole line of rebuttal is built on the idea that my issue was, why is she not outwardly performing Swedishness? But my actual issue is that the songwriting feels impersonal and market calibrated. Those are different arguments. And I think it says a lot that instead of engaging the actual critique that the song feels generic because it speaks to a fantasy rather than from a self, people turned it into this sillier argument about me wanting foreigners to explain their culture to me. This is the clickbaitification of my review by people who either didn't listen to it properly or started rage spiraling before I finished it. I made a separate point that is more directly about Sweden though, sort of, but not as Zara Larsson's national identity. I'm talking about it as a musical lineage. Here's what I said.
For someone who loves to reference Max Martin in interviews and the school of Swedish pop, there's no evidence that she's actually internalized any of those skills, and she's not exactly selecting producers who are known for creating that type of excellence anyway.
So this is the place where I actually was talking about a Swedish heritage, and what I meant was very specific. Again, I'm not talking about clogs and maypoles. I was talking about the tradition of Swedish pop craft, Max Martin, ABBA, Robin, precision engineered, melodically airtight, emotionally efficient pop construction that has shaped modern pop music at the highest level. What I'm saying is, if Zara Larsson or the discourse around Zara Larsson wants to position herself in relation to this Swedish pop excellence, which she has often mentioned directly herself, in this heritage of immaculate melodic design and pop architecture, where is that rigor on this album? Where is the melodic math? To my ear, there isn't that strict sense of melodic exactness. That is me listening to the song's construction and thinking it doesn't meet the standard of craftsmanship implied by all this talk of Swedish pop lineages, which is wildly different from saying, why doesn't Zara Larsson have more Swedish culture in her lyrics? But again, people collapsed the two points together and then made up their own version of what I said.
Where is her Swedish cultural heritage in any of her music?
The album is literally called The Midnight Sun. The Midnight Sun is when the sun doesn't set in the summer in Sweden, and Zara Larsson literally named her entire album about that.
Again, this is just smooth brain interpretation of the review. The album title referencing a Scandinavian phenomenon is not what I was discussing when I talked about Swedish melodic math. A symbolic title is not the same thing as a record actually embodying the craft tradition that it invokes. We're operating on different planes here. People got even more confused when they tried to explain to me that American pop has been heavily shaped by Swedish producers. Yes. Correct. Obviously, I know that. That is in many ways exactly my point. If Swedish pop architecture has been this foundational force in modern commercial pop, and if Zara is gesturing towards that tradition, then why does this record, in my opinion of my review, which is an exemplar of my taste, so often sound merely functional instead of structurally brilliant? That's the question I asked. Nobody has tried to answer it. They just replaced it with more outlandish questions instead. There was also this bizarre and more loaded move in some of the responses that I do think is worth directly addressing. And let's keep in mind, we're talking about music made by a very white person, because some people did not just disagree with me. They tried to frame what I said as culturally ignorant, microaggressive, or coded in a way that I think is slippery and frankly irresponsible. The clearest example of that is the MNEK point that I made. Here's what I said.
MNEK and Zone are very serviceable, but their production on this album is boilerplate. It's polished and professional, but it's very, very average.
And the interpretation was...
into the comments that he said about MNEK, which felt a little too loaded and a bit coded. That boilerplate commentary about MNEK's production has to come from someone who is desperately uncultured.
First of all, I'm not going to sit here and be branded uncultured by an American. So let's start there. As though that is some objective diagnosis of my life experience, I was born and raised here in Singapore, a very small but extremely multicultural city-state where multiple languages, religions, and communities live side by side as your everyday background. I challenge you to find Singapore on a map. I'm not claiming to be some sort of omnivorous musical polymath, but I am also not speaking from the very specific US-centric media bubble that people are trying to project onto me. More importantly though, even leaving all of that aside, calling production boilerplate or average is not a microaggression simply because the producer is black and you did not enjoy hearing that criticism. That's not what a microaggression is or what coded language means. If the bar for those words now is he thought a beat was mid, therefore there must be something racially suspect going on, then those terms have lost all useful meaning. In my case, it is an especially strange accusation because I have praised MNEK before, enthusiastically. His work with Little Mix is some of my favorite pop music of the last decade. I know exactly how good he can be. I know the level of intention, punch, and emotional charge he is capable of bringing to a track, which is part of why I found this production underwhelming. If anything, that critique presumes respect. I'm not saying MNEK is talentless. I am saying I know he is talented, I rate him highly, and I think that this batch of material from him sounds boilerplate. That is a completely normal critical opinion. If you want to argue with that, why don't you argue with it musically? Tell me why the production is inventive. Tell me why it is textured, surprising, dynamic, or emotionally potent. Tell me what I missed. That would be a constructive critical disagreement. But trying to launder, I don't like your opinion about this producer through the language of prejudice is just a way of making criticism radioactive so that you don't have to engage with it honestly. And the same goes for the American perspective accusation.
And I don't think he's necessarily American. I did a quick Google search before talking about this, but it said that he like grew up in Singapore, but went to school in New York and then moved back to Singapore or something like that. He sounds American, right? And he talks about American music a lot. I think that it is really unfortunate when people who are American or just people in general demand or expect artists from different countries or different cultures to display their culture in a way that they will understand.
Again, first of all, I am not American, and a simple Google search will tell you that. That premise is simply wrong. But even if I were, you would still have to substantiate that charge from the review itself. You can't just assign me a nationality, then attach a worldview to that nationality, then attach a motive to that worldview, and then present that stack of assumptions, which are wrong, as if it is a rebuttal. But in fact, my beloved, you are writing fanfiction. My actual review contains a songwriting critique and a production critique. That's what's there in the text. The rest is projection. I think this is where the discourse gets especially dishonest and frustrating, because instead of saying, I disagree with your assessment, people inflate it into your assessment reveals something morally suspect about you as a person. They make the disagreement more politically charged than the source material justifies, and then they respond to that inflated version of it instead. This is textbook anti-intellectualism. Now I want to talk about the tone of the response. Once you've morally inflated a disagreement in taste like that, suddenly the personal attacks are licensed. It's not just that I didn't think an album was revolutionary, now I'm ignorant and microaggressive. These are the basic internet hunting principles. The mob then has full license to get pretty ugly.
Sorry, I'm not flirting with you. I got something in my eye, and it's definitely the audacity of this bit. Unfortunately for him, I'm within the demographic of people that find Swiftologist to be exceptionally, like, insufferable because of his negative review style just basically being a repackage of Ryan Murphy's soliloquies, and it's grating. It's recited in a cadence of, like, a frantic field mouse that has a really aggressive case of gay face.
Honestly, you should tread very carefully, little boy. Do you know what a jersey bead is? No, of course not. You're wearing fucking Laneige on your lips. Open a book. Close your mouth.
Can we pause and look at the proportion here? I said the album was mid. They said I have a gay face. I said the production was average. They started speculating about my nationality, my life experience, my accent, my taste, my sexuality, my lip gloss, which by the way is Victoria Beckham Beauty and never Laneige, and my entire personhood. Many other people said way worse things about me, but I'm capping it with these fairly tame but still unnecessary personal attacks to spare you all from the secondhand embarrassment about behaving this way over a Zara Larsson album review. The asymmetry in the tone of the response to my review versus the actual review itself isn't just mean. I honestly can care less about personal attacks. I've been in writing workshops for a very long time. I've had my work picked apart for sport so many times. And at the age of 29, with the success I've had in my career thus far, I don't feel threatened by attacks of this nature. I know who I am and I know what my intentions are. But I find these meltdowns interesting because they tell us something about what kind of disagreement is being staged. My review confines itself to the work, the songs, the production, the lineage that it gestures towards, and the persona that it constructs. I don't make a habit of attacking artists' faces, bodies, or private lives. I wouldn't dream of making a video about a female artist that centers on cheap shots rather than the music. If I'm going to do that to anyone, it's not a pop girl, it's Ed Sheeran. And it's because first and foremost, the music sucks, in my opinion. I'm not out there just panning people for fun or for sport. Yes, I deliver my reviews with bite. There's a little bit of wittiness, it's camp, it's entertainment. I am not Wikipedia. That is part of why people watch me. But underneath that, there is a basic good faith rule. The criticism has to be about the art or the public narrative around it. I don't go into a review wanting to pan something, and I don't treat artists as acceptable collateral damage for a good joke. I actually very rarely review artists that I don't like or have an investment in. The negative opinions that I arrive at are the result of thinking about the work, not a pretext for humiliating the person who made it. What has happened to me in a lot of these rebuttals is almost the inverse. They start from a conclusion, this person must be punished for not joining the consensus around an album or an artist, and then they work backwards to justify that punishment. Once you decide someone needs to be shamed for deviating from the group feeling, almost anything becomes fair game. Their appearance, their voice, their accent, their supposed national identity, their sexuality. This is like when Justin Tranter felt the need to call me a cocksucker with a ring light. The goal is not to answer the argument, it's just to discredit the speaker. It's lazy. The latest warping of critical discourse is the social disciplining of anyone who falls out of line in the groupthink. This isn't just happening in music criticism, it's everywhere. Now I want to turn my attention to why people are telling me that I need to retract my statements. Is Zara Larsson having a moment or a resurgence? I think she's very obviously having a moment. I would not argue against that. She is more visible, memed, and broadly known than she ever has been in years. Again, maybe ever. There is a true wave of goodwill around her, specifically in the US, which is a market she's been desperate to crack. There are a few compelling reasons why this is happening. People definitely like the Kia Asylum escapee narrative, the performance clips, the Slay stateside feature, and the feeling of watching someone blow up. This is the same kind of audience satisfaction that initially drove Chapel Roan's tour de force. But what's most peculiar about this case study and why I stand by my initial review is that basically everything except the album Midnight Sun is driving Zara's return to the public eye. What's the difference between blowing up and having a moment? Blowing up is not one viral performance clip or one feature or one nostalgia trend on TikTok or one round of she's so underrated actually discourse. Blowing up is repeatable audience attention across multiple songs, not just one song or trend, commercial traction in more than one market and more than one format, streams, charting, and touring as well. With that in mind, let's dive into what actually is driving Zara Larsson's moment. Who knew opening up would make her a headline indeed? Zara's first big reputational shift did not come from Midnight Sun. It came from her magnetic stage presence. Clips from her opening slot on Tate McRae's Miss Possessive tour circulated because she looked like a real pop star, confident, vocally secure, dancing, joking with the crowd. Specifically, that cover of Gimme More was a flashpoint. The lift in Midnight Sun was iconic too, but it wasn't her songs or the music that was piquing people's interest. It was her star power. You can feel the comment section realization when you go back and look at the videos. Oh wait, she's really good. And the narrative around her career suddenly starts to tilt from why is Zara still trying to why has Zara been trapped in the Kia Asylum this whole time? The second pillar of her moment is Stateside, which is importantly not a Zara Larsson single, but a Pink Pantherist track that she guests on. The Zara remix version becomes the one that takes off. It sits on Pink Pantherist's remix project. It goes properly global. And as of early March 2026, it has gone top 10 on both the US and global Spotify charts. It hit number one on Spotify's global daily chart and gave Zara her first ever Billboard Hot 100 top 10 hit. This is huge for her visibility and credibility, but it's also a little bit of a parasitic visibility. The hit belongs to the Pink Pantherist universe. Zara is the featured weapon, not the primary architect. It proves that she can show up and sell a moment on the right canvas, just like her opening slot at Tate McRae's tour did, but it doesn't prove that Midnight Sun is a secretly misunderstood classic that I now need to apologize for interpreting wrong. The third component of Zara's blow up is pure nostalgia economics. Lush Life is the avatar of a broader 2016 is back trend, with Welcome Back 2016 edits, 2016 outfit recreations, all reanchoring Zara to a time that people now remember as carefree and fun. There's also the Lush Life dance, which she invited fans to do on stage that became a viral trend too. Again, do you see what I'm seeing here? People aren't suddenly diving into Midnight Sun and saying, you're the main pop girl. Lush Life came out a decade ago, hit of the century, by the way, but this isn't because of Midnight Sun. I think there's also an argument that the general music ecosystem right now is unusually favorable to a competent, charismatic pop girl. A lot of the traditional main pop girl slots are either between eras, directionless, or in minor cycles commercially. The bar for someone is serving is lower than it would be in a crowded year. Q1 is also notoriously not stacked with big releases. In that landscape, an artist who can deliver tight performances, a strong feature, and a nostalgic hit feels bigger than she might have in a more competitive season. That context doesn't invalidate her moment at all, but it provides context. This wouldn't have been happening in 2024, the year of the pop girl, not with that album material. So has Zara Larsson actually escaped the Kia asylum? I'd say for now, it's a moment, but there is strong escape potential on the horizon if she plays her cards right. By my own standards from the pop girl ladder video, I would say yes, she has made it over the wall. On the ladder now, I'd put her at a solid level 3B, a niche diva in training with a largely internet-based fan base. Most of her current power is still internet heavy and context dependent. Clock app edits, stan enthusiasm, a feature on someone else's hit, stateside strutting into the Hot 100 top 10 and the upper reaches of global streaming is a huge symbolic jailbreak moment, but she's still, again, appearing there as a feature, not running her own era. In other words, I think Zara's on parole from the Kia asylum. She's a recognizable, actively loved pop girl with momentum, but whose wins are still partially borrowed from nostalgia, collaborations, and other people's eras. There is absolutely scope for her to climb into a 3A position, the newer pop girls who the industry decides to throw their weight behind as potential future main pop girls. And I think that Midnight Sun Deluxe is realistically her best shot at that. If she lands a bona fide solo hit off of that campaign, something that lives on her artist page and moves as decisively as stateside has all by herself, then I think we can start talking about a full independent escape off parole from the Kia asylum. Right now though, the album I reviewed is much more of a passenger in this story than the engine. Its highest charting single, Midnight Sun, still hasn't cracked the top 50 in most major markets. Was I wrong? No, I reviewed the record. What's happening now is a broader pop cultural moment built on performance, persona, nostalgia, virality, and one extremely efficient collaboration. Those things are tangentially related to the album, but they are not the same thing, and they don't retroactively change how the songs on Midnight Sun actually sound to me. Which brings me to the people who helped turn one middling review into a referendum, not just Zara's fans, but Zara herself and her collaborators. I want to be fair and clear here. I don't think that artists should have to sit in silence while critics talk about them like they're not in the room, but I do wonder if what happens when they wade into these conversations on social media is a good idea for anyone, the critic, the artist, the fans, or the discourse. Let me start with Zara Larsson because she's the case study on the table. She is terminally online. Her "I disagree" heart emoji comment under my review is, in isolation, fine, a little bit shady. She is absolutely allowed to disagree with me. But it's not a meaningful engagement with anything I actually said. She's not arguing about the songwriting, defending her production instincts, or clarifying her intentions, and she doesn't have to. However, that means her comment only has one purpose. It directs attention. Midnight Sun got plenty of positive coverage. There was no shortage of praise she could have amplified if the goal was simply to support her album. Choosing instead to spotlight the one widely seen negative review doesn't hurt me. I can handle it. I can dish it and take it. But it does single me out in a way that feels more like a little public ding than a good faith attempt at a dialogue. It's not really the spirit of constructive engagement that I try to bring when I discuss other people's work. If this were an isolated incident, it wouldn't be that interesting. What makes it interesting is that it slots into a very old, ancient, and messy tradition. Artists and critics have always been in a kind of forced marriage. They irritate each other, they need each other, and occasionally they maybe even try to kill each other off. Stick with me. I'm going to do a bit of an academia coke rant. I promise that it's relevant. In the 19th century, critic John Ruskin was so scathing about James McNeill Whistler's painting that Whistler sued him for libel. The lawsuit bankrupted Whistler, but also turned the review into free publicity and cemented both men's place in art history forever. For a long time, that was the shape of the relationship between artist and critic. Poisonous essays in small journals, letters to the editor, grumbling in salons. The circle was tiny, and so the collateral damage was very limited. In the 20th century, you get a different version of the same dance. Rock critics at Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, NME, wrote with open contempt about artists who then inevitably became canon. Punk bands made zines and songs, mocking the inkies and the suits who didn't get it, even as those same writers helped build their mythology. Art critic Tom Wolfe's whole argument in his book The Painted World was that by the late 20th century, critics weren't just judging art, they were effectively co-authoring it, supplying the theory you needed to make sense of otherwise opaque work. This is especially true in our postmodern world. The relationship was combative, but also symbiotic. Everyone understood the scale and the stakes. Social media has really disrupted that equilibrium. The spat is no longer between one artist and one reviewer in a newspaper column, it's between an artist with millions of followers and usually an individual critic, and it's mediated by an algorithm that definitely rewards outrage. A casual clapback that once once would have been a private sulk or a testy interview answer, is now a vehicle for the social humiliation rituals. There are many recent pop examples of this. Halsey's "Demolish the Basement They Run Pitchfork Out Of" tweet was clearly meant as a petty joke about a middling album score, but because Pitchfork's offices are based in the World Trade Center, it instantly blew up into a much larger controversy. She Streisand affected a bad review and made herself seem thin-skinned and myopic. Lana Del Rey, my diva over the last decade, has repeatedly named individual critics and publications that she feels have misrepresented her over her family background, plastic surgery, her supposed glamorization of abuse. You can absolutely understand her frustration. She has been caricatured and flattened by the press in ways that are misogynistic and genuinely unfair, so much so that music reviewers have re-reviewed and re-scored her earlier albums. But when she posts these long screeds on Instagram or lists specific writers, it can make her look like she's punching down. There's something to be said about letting the work speak for itself. In this day and age, even if the artist doesn't directly intervene, the logic is the same. Taylor Swift doesn't need to say a word for a critic to be bombarded. A perfectly positive 8 out of 10 review can spark days of harassment purely because it drags an average down. That's what happened to Jill Maples when she reviewed Folklore, beautifully, by the way. Fandoms have internalized the idea that anything short of maximal praise is not just wrong, but morally suspect. Evidence of bias, jealousy, misogyny, whatever frame makes it feel righteous to attack. There are, to be fair, serious arguments on the artist's side for intervening, though. I definitely think artists have the right to correct basic facts and context. Critics do misquote, mishear, or project. When someone like Lana says, "This story about my background is literally false," it's absolutely her right to correct that narrative. Artists, I think, also have the right to resist genuinely dehumanizing criticism. Historically, critics have been very vicious about women's bodies, queer people's lives, and artists of color in ways that are extremely grotesque. Part of why criticism has become more thoughtful is because artists have pushed back. Also, sometimes a public response from an artist can sharpen the conversation. When an artist says, "Here's what I was trying to do, and here's where I disagree with your reading of it," you can get a rare thing, an actual dialogue about craft and intent instead of parallel monologues. But I think there are also clear reasons to be wary of how this plays out now for artists. First of all, it's the scale. A painter confronting a critic 150 years ago affected a few hundred people. A pop star subtweeting a clock app reviewer in 2026 affects hundreds of thousands of people. The same gesture has very different consequences. And the myth that the critic always punches down is simply not true anymore. A freelance writer or an independent YouTuber is, in many cases, far more precarious than the major label artist they're reviewing. When the artist decides to clap back, the blow just isn't symmetrical. Every time a negative or even mixed review becomes a mini scandal because an artist, a producer, or a mega fan account highlighted it, everyone else who might have had a more nuanced opinion takes note of that. The cost of honesty inches up, and the safest position becomes enthusiastic consensus or silence. That's terrible not only for criticism, but also for art. Criticism only works if there is at least a little bit of daylight between saying what you think and being publicly punished for it. When we collapse that gap and every non-glowing review is treated as a personal attack requiring a dogpile, we edge towards a culture where reviews are just loyalty tests, not arguments or discussions about art. On my end, I'm not campaigning for a return to some golden age where critics were unchallenged gatekeepers and artists just had to take it on the chin in silence, but I do think there needs to be a distinction. If you want to argue about the music, argue. If you want to say, "This hurt me because it crossed a line from critiquing the work into mocking my trauma," for example, say that. Those are all forms of engagement that can make discourse sharper and create conversation. What worries me in my situation with Zara Larsson and with Halsey and Lana Del Rey and Taylor Swift is a different pattern. Instead of engaging the substance of a critique, you mark the critic, the speaker, as a problem, ignorant, uncultured, microaggressive, jealous, whatever label makes you feel virtuous and you're piling on. That might feel satisfying in the moment. It might even juice your numbers to get them, but it erodes the space for honest criticism. And if we lose that, the results are catastrophic. We're already seeing it with the inshittification of pop and the way that artists have to be more calculated than ever before in this era of supposed authenticity. Justifying pile-ons and gang-ups won't fix that. You know what can? Honest, interesting, inspired, and electric conversations about music where people are not so entrenched in their own personal taste that they can't see beyond their blinders and try to appreciate the art for something bigger than just a tribe that you buy t-shirts for. I've been dying to say all of this for a while now, and I've been mulling it over and making notes and observing the way this discourse has evolved, all while bumping stateside and reposting the videos of Zara slaying on her tour. You see how two things can be true at once? Sound off in the comments below. I would love to hear your thoughts on everything I've presented to you today, and I will see you next week.